From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with the Wisconsin Medical Society about how physicians are handling the post-Roe landscape in the state. Then we'll look at a book about Stonewall, helping a younger generation better understand how the uprising impacted the gay rights movement.
You know, we always try to simplify our history, and there's been an oversimplification about Stonewall that says, you know, this was the spark that started the gay rights movement. And that's not really true. There had been a movement for decades before that.
We'll hear from the chef who won this year's James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant, which focuses on indigenous food.
The Western diet just has largely ignored, you know, all this amazing diversity around us with the plant world, and we should be better connected. We should be eating closer to the earth and the land.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Governor Tony Evers has announced a lawsuit challenging the 1849 abortion law in Wisconsin. The lawsuit argues that the law is unenforceable because it conflicts with the abortion measures state lawmakers have passed since the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. Here's Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call explaining why the lawsuit is being filed and what it's arguing.
The Supreme Court decision has made Wisconsin's women less safe, less equal, and less free. And we need to change that. Now, Governor Evers and I have taken decisive action in the last few days to minimize the harm from the Supreme Court's decision. Governor Evers has made clear that he will grant clemency in cases in which people are prosecuted under the old ban. My office has been clear that we will not use our resources to investigate or prosecute anybody under Wisconsin's 19th century ban. But minimizing the harm isn't enough. We need to do much, much more. So today we have filed a lawsuit that asks the courts to clarify that Wisconsin's 19th century abortion ban is not in effect. We are making two legal arguments in support of this case. Number one, there are a series of laws that were passed subsequent to Roe that provide regulation for lawful abortions in Wisconsin. Those statutes are directly inconsistent with Wisconsin's 19th century abortion ban. It can't be both legal and illegal to provide an abortion to protect the health of a mother. We've also argued that Wisconsin's abortion ban has fallen into disuse and can no longer be enforced under Wisconsin law. There's a legal doctrine known as desuetude that we argue applies here. Wisconsin's criminal abortion ban has been unenforceable for more than 50 years. Wisconsin actually had a decision that predates Roe, decided in 1970, that invalidated Wisconsin's abortion ban. So for over 50 years, abortion rights have been protected in Wisconsin. But even before those decisions, although there were abortion bans in most states around the country, people knew then what we continue to know, which is that making abortion illegal doesn't stop abortion. It stops safe and legal abortion. In fact, when those bans were in place, abortion was commonplace, but the laws were very rarely enforced, and they were disparately enforced. So we have contended that those laws, because of the history of limited enforcement and the fact that they haven't been enforced for more than 50 years, no longer can be in effect in Wisconsin. I want to add, too, that you know, there has been discussion from the Supreme Court about returning this issue to the states. But what we're talking about, if this 19th century ban is enforced, is not returning this issue to the states. We're talking about returning Wisconsin to the 19th century. This law was passed well before women had the right to vote. It was passed before the Civil War. It uses terminology that is outdated and leaves doctors and others uncertain as to what exactly the law provides for. And that law cannot fairly be said after 50 years of being invalid to represent the will of the people of the state of Wisconsin. If legislators think there should be an abortion ban in Wisconsin, they should go into session and pass that legislation. I'm confident the governor will veto it, but legislators, if they want this law enforced, need to stand by it. A bill that was enacted before any of them was born, before anybody here was born. So today we are bringing suit. We are seeking to have the 1800s ban declared unenforceable, and we are also going to continue to fight for legislation.
That was Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. And although some public officials are vowing to not enforce the law, Wisconsin's 1849 abortion law is still having an impact on the kind of medical care people can access in the state. Dr. Jerry Halverson is the chair of the Board of Directors for the Wisconsin Medical Society, which put out a statement just after Roe v. Wade was overturned, asking for Wisconsin leaders to clarify the law and stating their belief that decisions over medical care should be limited to a patient and their physician. Dr. Halverson joins me now to talk about the situation. Dr. Halverson, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me to be here.
What are some of the issues your organization is having in interpreting Wisconsin's 1849 abortion law?
There's a number of issues that we've had. Clearly, we have been comfortable with what had been the law of the land and what had allowed our doctors and patients to make important healthcare decisions. But like you, we've all had to become experts in 1800 law. So the concerns that we have as physicians in Wisconsin are now potentially subject to a pre-Civil War era law that has physicians potentially facing a prison term for providing women with a specific subset of healthcare. There's the life of a mother that's in there, but again, what does that mean? To what level does a mom's health have to degrade before performing an abortion? We don't even know what that means. What if the fetus is no longer alive, but isn't immediately threatening the mother's life? Can an abortion be performed at that point, or will they have to carry the dead fetus inside of their body until naturally the delivery would happen? There are just a lot of questions and a lot of concerns about now us having this law getting in the way of physicians being able to treat patients the way that their health demands they be treated.
Have you heard from physicians so far with concerns about how they're able to practice today? Because this law, as soon as Roe v. Wade was overturned, people started turning to it and going, okay, well, this is now the law of Wisconsin.
There still is a lot of confusion. Most of what I have heard from our members is basically the upset that there is something that's getting in the way of being able to give our patients the medically indicated care that they need. Upset about the government getting into this very sensitive topic and this very important topic, period. We know that abortions are oftentimes life-saving care and how necessary they are. It's not something that we like to see a lot of, but they're necessary. And frankly, I've heard a lot of our members just upset with how they feel, you know, like other citizens, how they feel that this treats women who should have every ability to control their own healthcare decisions with their physician.
Now, one of the questions I've had in looking at this law, and when I've spoken to legal experts, they've had questions about this. Because of the age of this law, some of the wording's a little odd, but one of the things it does is it defines life as starting from conception. How is your organization interpreting that? How have you heard people interpreting that? Because it, in some ways, that effectively outlaws a variety of birth control methods.
At this point, we're still trying to learn as much as we can. The medical society has pretty strong policy that supports a woman's ability to have an abortion if they need it or if they want it. As far as when life begins, whether it's at conception or whether when they first feel the heartbeat, there's just a lot of confusing terminology out there that frankly we're learning about just with everybody else.
So right now, does it seem like physicians are continuing to insert IUDs, continuing to prescribe a variety of hormonal birth controls that can have an impact, or honestly, even medications that are not meant for birth control, but also have an impact on an embryo or fetus. Are physicians continuing to prescribe those?
Well, I can tell you, we have not been recommending to our members that they change their practice at this time. We are attempting to learn more about how this law will be enforced. We have heard that the state attorney general says that it might not be enforceable. It's obviously a really old law, so the courts are going to be involved in this. And the governor has also said pretty clearly that he will grant clemency to physicians providing abortions or these types of services. And we've also heard that some district attorneys and county sheriffs are not going to enforce the law, but obviously it's all very ad hoc all over the state, and it's not clear how different officials will act. So we haven't told our members that they should change their practice. They should continue to do what they feel in their medical judgment is best with their patients. But clearly, it's just it's a mess. It's a massive mess.
Well, and it seems like it comes down to an individual physician, whatever they feel most comfortable with. And understandably, I think a lot of people are concerned about, as you've mentioned, not just prosecution, but criminal prosecution.
That is what some of that says in there. Obviously, it is something that's very concerning to us. I mean, again, not only gets in the way of decision making, but also threatens the physicians with jail time. Yeah, it's very concerning.
Now, one of the things at issue here is, in order to change the law, there would have to be some action from the legislature. Of course, they did have an opportunity to do that. They gaveled in and out within, I think, about 25 seconds and didn't really take any action. What are you hoping to get as far as clarity, as far as possible legislation from a legislature that doesn't seem that interested in clarifying the law?
Yeah, it's a challenge. Obviously, we feel that this is a threat to our ability to work with our patients and get our patients the care that they need. We've called for legislation that really makes it clear that the government should not interfere with the physician-patient relationship, particularly by holding the specter of criminal charges above a physician's head. We do think that this law, you know, that makes it clear, really should acknowledge the right of a physician to perform and counsel on abortion procedures, or if they want to, refuse to do so. If the physician doesn't want to give that advice or perform those services, they would certainly be able to refer to another physician that would.
As we look at this law moving forward, if we don't get clarity from the legislature, what is your organization willing to do to defend the rights of your members to practice and for patients to get care?
As I said, we're absolutely trying to figure out what we can do, what there is to do. We have already started reaching out to legislators, attempting to get some clarity, as we had talked about before. As a membership organization, our goal is to support the health of the citizens of Wisconsin and our the physician's right to provide that. So we have, as an advocacy organization, we have an ability to make clear what we think what the physicians of Wisconsin need. So we're trying to do whatever we can to support the ability of our physicians to be able to be involved in these medically necessary procedures and medically necessary situations without the threat of going to jail or being fined.
All right. Well, Dr. Halverson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, sharing a bit of your work. And I hope to hear from you soon as we get more clarity.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Dr. Jerry Halverson is the chair of the Board of Directors for the Wisconsin Medical Society. At WUWM.com, you can find more of our coverage on abortion access in Wisconsin. This week marks the anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York City, an event that's widely considered a turning point in LGBTQ history. that transformed the gay liberation movement and the fight for LGBTQ rights in the U.S. But the fight didn't end there. In 2015, Anne Bousum wrote a book about the Stonewall Uprising, with the hope of reaching a younger audience of readers who may not know what happened at Stonewall, and bring to light how it changed a movement that continues today. Mitch Tyke spoke to Bousum when her book was released.
Now, I think Stonewall, for many people, sits out there as a landmark moment in the history of gay rights, but for a lot of people, probably, it kind of stops there. Like, what people might know about the battles of Concord and Lexington or the Treaty of Versailles. You were not so old when the Stonewall riots happened. What did you know, and maybe more importantly, what didn't you know as you set out to write this book?
Well, I didn't know very much. I would have been about 10 when the Stonewall riots happened, 10 or 11. And I was living in Virginia at the time.
Probably not a lot of coverage.
Not a lot of coverage in New York City at the time. The homosexual community was so marginalized at that time that it wasn't really considered news that there was a gay riot in Greenwich Village. And so I lived in New York after college. I'm a graduate of Boyd College and lived in New York City and became familiar with the riots just as a general idea from living in New York. And I think had I been a member of the LGBT community, I would have been much more familiar with it because that is one of those touchstones of history that is the foundation of kind of the heritage that's passed on from one generation to the next. And I did not realize, for example, that the gay pride parades, which occur around the globe now in late June of every year, were originally established as a tribute to the Stonewall riots. And that's very well known within the gay community. And I'm really glad that I've been able to try to bring that history out into the open for all of us to appreciate. It's a fantastic story.
Well, and there is a lot that's kind of more subtle about what actually took place on that, you know, overnight between June 27th and 28, 1969, that people are probably not aware of. For example, I had no idea that there was an angle of this that involved the mafia.
No, nor did I. When I started the research, I had the impression that there was a raid at a gay bar, that it was one raid too many, and the riots that followed were triggered by this straightforward raid. And that was not the case at all. And I think most people have that misconception that this was just a gay bar raid that set off a spark that triggered riots. In fact, by the time of the riots in mid-1969, running a gay bar was not illegal. In New York City, going to a gay bar was not illegal. Dancing at a gay bar was not illegal.
All and these things had been illegal a couple of years
these
before.
These things had been illegal. They were in this gray area at the time when the Stonewall was opened in 1967. And the mafia was getting into the gay bar business at that time because since it was illegal, it created this opportunity for exploitation and moneymaking. And there was a wink and nod system that evolved with the police that allowed these bars to open and stay open through a payoff system. And that heritage was evolving by the time of the Stonewall riots. And the mafia still ran these bars, and they weren't necessarily illegal, but illegal behavior was going on at them. And this was a time when it was still very common to be in the closet because there was not legal protection that could keep you from losing your job, et cetera.
Right. The existence of a gay bar wasn't illegal and dancing at a gay bar wasn't illegal, but you could still easily be fired from your job.
Right. Being gay could get you in all kinds of trouble. And so this was being exploited at these mafia-run gay bars in Greenwich Village, and people were being blackmailed. And the police had become aware of this, and so these bars were being targeted by the police in an effort to try to stop this blackmailing. And the thought was to try to put the Stonewall out of business, not because it was doing the blackmailing, because that can be hard to prove, but because it had a kind of a sketchy liquor license. And it had set itself up in 1967 under this sort of sketchy legal code because it was trying to skirt under these laws that where it was still kind of a gray area, were they opening a legal business or not?
But at the same time, if so, the idea was they would try to shut the Stonewall Inn down under the pretense that they were trying to deal with these sketchy liquor laws or the sketchy liquor business they were in. And at the same time, if closing it down meant that the blackmail would go away, then that...
Exactly. So it was kind of a roundabout way to shut down the blackmailing. And oh, by the way, the bar's going to end up being closed too.
But this distinction does not necessarily matter at all to the regular patrons of the Stonewall.
No, they're just ticked off. And they're old enough to have witnessed plenty of police raids and to have thought they were done. And one other thing that's often not known about the history is that this wasn't the first time the Stonewall had been raided by this operation. That had happened just a few days earlier. And so many of the people who were there Friday night had already witnessed a police raid on Tuesday night. And in contrast to the earlier raid, this one occurred after midnight on a Friday night, under a full moon, on a very hot evening, and potential catalysts for trouble.
You went through a lot of different historical information about what had taken place that night. And what's interesting is there are seemingly a ton of archives of writings from people who were either there when the raids began or people who gravitated toward the raid, towards the raid and the riots that ensued afterwards. What were the remarkable threads you found as you started examining these contemporary writings and perhaps speaking with people who were there that night?
I think that the threads that emerged from the historical record were almost uniformly full of rage. And just this fed-upness and this crystallizing moment came together right then, right there, and all of the factors fed into an uprising.
Were there particular challenges you ran into in writing about Stonewall for a younger audience?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a publisher who believed in the project and believed in telling the history unchecked. And my target audience is the teenage reader. I think we live in a world where they're encountering pretty sophisticated material, and I didn't feel constrained in being able to talk about this history in a straightforward and honest way.
And, of course, the book does come along as gay rights are very much a regular part of the news and a regular part of the landscape.
Absolutely. The book seems to be coming out at just the time when the readership might most want and appreciate the chance to learn this backstory to the current gay rights movement.
Well, and it's worth noting that the book does not end with the end of the Stonewall riots and their immediate aftermath. You do kind of go into some of the landmarks along the way for both gay rights and issues that the gay community faces in the years and the decades since.
Yeah, I felt that was very important. You know, we always try to simplify our history, and there's been an oversimplification about Stonewall that says, you know, this was the spark that started the gay rights movement. And that's not really true. There had been a movement for decades before that, and the movement would have continued without it. But Stonewall certainly was a catalyzing moment in turning what was a relatively small movement into a much larger one. But just as young people today aren't going to know about Stonewall, they're also not going to know about what happened in the decades since. And I felt it was important to give that preview of what had come before and a sense of what had come after so that I really could bring the readers up to current times and also use the gay rights movement to illustrate the same ups and downs that every social justice movement has. It wasn't just this wonderful arc from Stonewall to marriage equality. There were a vast array of challenges along the way.
Anne Bousum is the author of Stonewall, Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights. She spoke to Mitch Tyke in 2015. Tomorrow, as Pride Month wraps up, we'll hear from Milwaukee LGBTQ activist Elle Hill, a Black woman of trans experience. She'll address Stonewall and what's happening in Milwaukee to protect and advocate for the LGBTQ community. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about the history of tide houses in Wisconsin and where you can still see remnants of them today. But first, we'll meet a James Beard award-winning chef who's working to revitalize indigenous food systems. That's coming up on Lake Effect. on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Sean Sherman has cooked in kitchens across the U.S. and Mexico for over three decades. Sherman was raised on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, home to the Oglala Lakota Nation. He now focuses his work on the revitalization of indigenous food systems. In 2017, Sherman and his team presented the first decolonized dinner at the prestigious James Beard House in Manhattan. A year later, Sherman won a James Beard Award for his first book, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. In 2019, he won another James Beard for leadership. Last year, Sherman opened Awamni in Minneapolis. The restaurant's menu is strictly indigenous and earned another James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant of 2022. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz caught up with Sherman at the 31st Annual Energy Fair in Wisconsin, where he delivered the keynote speech. Sherman begins with how his childhood in South Dakota led to the work he does today.
Both my parents grew up a little bit different. My dad came from a family that they had a lot of siblings and very little money, and my dad's dad was kind of an extreme alcoholic too, and struggling as most of his life. So I feel like my dad had a lot of struggles growing up, and really wanted to get away from the reservation. So I remember they told me he tried to sign up for the Marines and ended up getting drafted and went into Vietnam shortly after there, which of course was a huge mess, you know. And then my mom, her family had a little bit more because they had a ranch, but still not comparatively. So we still grew up in the middle of nowhere for the most part. But, you know, I think there was just so much missing, because going to school on the reservation, and, you know, we did have things like Lakota class, so we learned, you know, Lakota names of colors and animals and things like that in school. But still, we were missing a lot. You know, our stories were there, our dances were there, we just went to the powwows and the ceremonies, and there was pieces, but food was always never really there. Like, we had some traditional recipes that were obviously not traditional to indigenous, but they seemed more church-based, really. So they seemed like, I remember my mom gave me a small book of recipes from Pine Ridge, and it read like a Lutheran cookbook, basically, you know, so it didn't really showcase that much. It just used a few Lakota words here and there and didn't really have much, and maybe there was some bison on there, but there wasn't much, you know. So it just, when I had the epiphany of the work I was doing, was because I was in the culinary field, and it just seemed completely crazy that I didn't know anything about my own heritage, and I'd been learning cultures from all over the world, and I knew very little about my own family. So it just set me on a path to understand it, and, you know, it's going to be a lifetime of learning.
So what do you think struck that epiphany? What was it that was going on that specifically at that time, you know, the light went off?
I was actually living in Mexico because I had just kind of gotten out of a really hard job where I was working way too many hours as a chef, which happens, and took a hiatus, just grabbed a backpack and a guitar and headed down to Mexico and lived on this little beach town about a little ways north of Puerto Vallarta in the state of Nayarit. And as I was down there, there was an indigenous group there called the Huichol, and I became really curious. I started researching and just reading about them. And that's when it just kind of hit me, because I just realized that they were like my long-distance indigenous cousins, because they were all from the land and all from the continent. And I just really became curious, and I just kind of saw a path. I saw like a flash, so I just really saw the future, and I just knew what I needed to learn. I knew what I needed to do, and I just set me on a path.
So stepping back or to the side, you did have an entry point into learning more about plants when you were first out of high school, I think.
Yeah, I mean, growing up on the reservation, we were able to identify things like the prairie turnip or harvest chokecherries, and some of those things are still active and still are in the communities. But the Forest Service job really helped me, because I had to learn the names of the plants because that was the job I had. And, you know, then it just really kind of stuck with me, of just always knowing that there's all this food and flavor around us, you know. And when I started really trying to think about how to implement some of this into the work that we're doing, it just made sense, you know, to really utilize this on a culinary situation and showcase how beautiful this food and this flavor is and kind of go from there. And I was able to tell so much story through food.
It's knowing not to say weeds for everything. It's learning names versus assuming it must be yucky. But also there's a relationship and there's a stewardship involved with harvesting from the land, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a connection when you're really identifying the plants and starting to relearn some of the native names even of all these plants around us. And we just wanted to create education around that so people could have access to that and just make it an active daily situation. And we try to feature a lot of these really wonderful flavors in at the restaurant with the foods at Awamni, just to showcase that it can still be done, you know, because again, the Western diet just has largely ignored, you know, all this amazing diversity around us with the plant world. And we should be better connected. We should be eating better, closer to the earth and the land, and utilizing the plants and trees that like to grow really well where we are. So it's a good way to do that.
So if you were hanging around here, you'd go into this currently wet woods and harvest some stuff.
Right. I mean, because mulberries are just starting to barely come out. There's a bunch of raspberries and blackberries about ready to pop. The bergamots haven't even flowered yet, you know, and the hyssops are coming up, and there's wild mints, and there's just so much flavor out there.
You talked about an epiphany, but you were in the midst of an explosion of activity and projects, right? I mean, you started that journey. Did the first tangible piece, was that the food truck, or was there stuff you were doing before then?
Well, so I finally formed the company in 2014, and it took me a few years, and I had done some pop-up dinners, so I was kind of doing that situation where I would just be like, let's just create a dinner and find some friends and find a place to do it and put a poster up and get people to sign up for a dinner, you know. And so I was doing that kind of pop-up work, just showcasing that we could create these really wonderful foods, and people just became very curious about it, you know. And I ended up starting to get invited to do talks about it, which I hadn't really considered, but I just started just sharing with what I knew. It turned into something completely different, and it helped me focus a lot of the studies to really use that stage and that platform to talk about the histories, to talk about a lot of these issues that people really don't know about, and to really share a lot of the hardships that we went through as Indigenous peoples and continue to go through. So I just was very intentional about the stage that came to me.
So when you, did the restaurant come first or the lab? The lab, right?
Yes.
Or is it sort of simultaneous?
I formed the company in 2014 after doing a few pop-ups and practicing. Then I started doing catering, started doing speaking engagements, signed the book, found Beth, who helped me write the book, and then signed a contract with the Little Earth Community of United Tribes to do the food truck and develop the food truck. And then we did a Kickstarter and got money for a restaurant. And then there's the proposal for a vendor of where we are now, and we won that proposal and became the vendor of that space overlooking the Mississippi downtown Minneapolis,
which is a significant location.
Very significant location, and you know, some of it was luck and some of it's probably meant to be. But
so talk about that location.
So Awamni, the name of the restaurant, downtown Minneapolis, sits on the banks of where the locks and dams are, but it used to be the site of this really beautiful waterfall that was in its pristine time about 300 feet across and about 30 feet down. So it's a really large drop. And the Dakota people call that waterfall Awamni Yamni. So they use the short name Awamni to describe that location. So if people were coming, there was always a village there. There was a place to travel across the river in Portage. And there was a lot of trade going on there, a lot of meetings with other groups there. And it was a really significant, important spot. And the Dakota people, the name for the Mississippi River itself is Hahawakpa, which means River of the Falls, which meant that very location. So it's like the heart of the entire Mississippi right there. So it's just got so much significance, you know, and our restaurant overlooks that space. But when the colonial machine moved into Minnesota and all the big mills came around, they started drilling under the waterfalls, and they eventually collapsed parts of it, and they had to they put up concrete skirting and things like that because they ruined it, you know. So the city's been trying to make that riverfront a little bit more usable, and this restaurant project is just feel very lucky to be in that exact location.
So if I asked you what was being served tonight in your restaurant, you probably wouldn't know because you haven't been there lately.
No, we have a pretty good family-style meal menu that we serve throughout the summer season, and it's just built so people can just come in and order a bunch of pieces and share and taste everything together. And we have specials that change a lot and entrees that change a lot, and we just try to roll with the seasons quite a bit. So it's good.
And you're pulling the food from, you know, from a tribe in Wisconsin, the fish for one, and other producers.
Yeah, we just try to prioritize purchasing from indigenous local first and then indigenous national next. And then we're able to get all sorts of great lake fish from the Great Lakes region, the bison from the plains. There's three native farms nearby us that we utilize a lot. We get a lot of our wild rice and maple and pieces like that from tribal communities. And we're just trying to pump as much money into tribal communities as possible and really create this demand around indigenous food and food production. And then with the nonprofit, creating a support system to help develop those on and create a distribution point also.
What have you seen at work within your staff as you've been an operation at the restaurant for less than a year, right?
Yeah.
But you've grown.
Yeah, we're growing fast. I think we have close to 120-ish employees right now with just the restaurant. And then we have the nonprofit, which I think we're over 30 employees now over there, which they're separated. But, yeah. You know, we're all kind of the same family. But we're just doing a lot. And we're just creating a really interesting space for just growing more indigenous everything, you know, whether it comes to education or food or creativity or and, you know, being able to get these huge nods like the James Beard Award that just happened and being named best new restaurant of the entire nation, which...
So don't ever think you're going to get in there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've been popular anyway since we've been open, but now there's just more people trying to get in and just... Well, you know, it'll balance out eventually. But we do have a lot of outdoor seating, so that does help during the summertime when the weather's nice.
You know, one thing that among many that strikes me is that you are so gracious when you talk about stewarding what's left and the number of families whose lives and generations have been turned upside down, probably isn't the right word even.
Right.
You're so gracious about welcoming in an audience and saying, you know, this is good for all of us. If we're able to start protecting and cherishing what's left, and you know, it's to everyone's benefit, I think it's super gracious that you're including all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is something that we all have to get through. We have to figure out how we can just be better in the future in general, you know, and we should be supporting and celebrating diversities that are out there and protecting a lot of this diversity that's still alive and just doing everything we can to be stewards of all of this, whether it's through food or through knowledge, like we have to protect it. So it's a call of action to everybody to take a part into helping to protect all of this for the future generations.
Sean Sherman is the chef at Awamni, a restaurant serving indigenous food in Minneapolis. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, you can search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll learn about the history of tide houses and beer gardens in Wisconsin. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's Wednesday, but because you heard the January 6th hearings at noon yesterday, we're bringing you our Tavern Tuesday series today. It's a partnership with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin, where we bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. For our final installment of Tavern Tuesdays, we'll hear again from Rob Novak. He is the Historic Brewing Experience Coordinator at Old World Wisconsin. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang chats with him about the lasting legacies of beer gardens and tide houses in Wisconsin.
I am not quite familiar what tide houses are. So to start off, what are tide houses? And also, while we're on it, what are beer gardens too? What are these two cultural institutions that Wisconsinites know so well?
Sure. Yeah, they go hand in hand historically because at one point in history, both would have been instituted or run by actual breweries. Beer gardens themselves, well, we know that they started in Bavaria, and the breweries there, they had these giant lagering caves. They lagered their beer over the summer, and by the mid-1500s, they actually were not allowed to brew in the summer. It was basically a rule that they had to follow. So in order to make money in the summer, they decided that they would sell the beer that they had been lagering in their caves. When they built the lagering caves, they would plant chestnut trees above them because they provided a ton of shade and they had very shallow roots so they wouldn't bother the caves themselves. And it just worked out perfectly that it was like a park-like setting. So in Germany, starting in about the 1500s, usually along a river, you'd see these beer gardens pop up. And they became popular very fast. And they were so popular that local tavern keepers instituted a law that beer gardens could sell beer and bread only, but not food, because people were just flocking to them and not going to the taverns. But people started bringing picnics. So early on in beer garden history, it was beer, maybe pretzels, some bread for sale, and you'd bring your own picnic. And that, in Germany, became a tradition. So by the time German immigrants started coming to the United States, they knew what beer gardens were. They used them for social activities, celebrations, just to get together with friends and family, the same things we do today. In Milwaukee, the beer gardens were run by the breweries, Schlitz, Pabst, Blatz. All of them had large beer gardens. Sometimes they evolved into almost like a theme park setting, and they would often have trams that ran out to them from the city. They're usually a couple miles out of the city. So in early Milwaukee history, so, you know, the mid to late 1800s, this was like a thriving industry. Now, tied houses were similar, but they were not always owned by the brewery. So a brewery would either build the tied house and then rent it out to someone who could run it, or they would supply everything in the bar for the owner of the bar to run it, provided that that person would be selling their beer. You'll see examples of tied houses all around Milwaukee. If you go up and down Brady Street or Water Street, just in any building, usually on a corner, you'll see a little bit of decorative elements, and sometimes you'll see like the brewing medallion. So Miller has the M, Pabst had their logo, Schlitz had the globe. You'll see historic breweries that aren't around anymore, and you'll wonder why that building has that on there, and it's because they were tied to a specific brewery.
That's really interesting. Generally, what does the architecture of former surviving tied houses look like?
Well, there is the idea that if the breweries made the buildings look nice and kind of made them a little bit ornate and just a little bit fancy, that they wouldn't get the reputation of like a tavern or a bar or something like that. And it would also help market that specific brewery. So when you go down and you see like Regano's Roman Coin on Brady Street, it's a really beautiful building. They're usually stone, a little bit of ornamentation around the windows on a cornice or something like that. And it, you know, catch your eye, and they're really beautiful buildings. And once you get inside, you'd see like a long bar. They're usually long and narrow rooms, really ornate bar, a nice back bar. And sometimes the breweries bought everything in there for the owner. You go through some of the records of what the breweries owned as far as stuff. And a lot of it was trims for tied houses, mirrors, decorations, all the way down to like tools they would use behind the bar. So they really kind of locked into the system of creating a space that people wanted to go to, and that space would then have to sell their beer. And this lasted, you know, all the way up until Prohibition started. Beer gardens kind of phased out because of the county park system, the temperance movement. Those things played a role in beer gardens kind of fading out before 1900. But the tied houses kept going right up till Prohibition.
What is the major difference between, say, a tied house and a tavern? Is it based on who's funding the building or funding the business? Or what is the large difference there?
The tavern, a regular bar, and bars today are, you know, they're free to buy from whoever they want to buy from. So you might have a Schlitz tap next to a Pabst tap, next to a Miller tap, or bottles next to each other. And the Tide houses, whether it was contractual or a handshake agreement or something, you know, it's all over the map, because these buildings were, they were in big cities, they were in small cities. They usually weren't rural, but they could be in a rural town, you know, because then it would be like the most substantial building in town. But yeah, that's the main difference is, you know, taverns, bars that aren't Tide houses would have been serving whatever they wanted, but they would have been supplying all their own materials. Whereas the Tide houses, you know, the breweries would come in and say, you know, either we want to buy this property and then lease it out to publican is what they called them when they ran pubs, but didn't own them. Or we noticed that you own this property. We'd like to help you develop it into a bar that will only serve our beer. Therefore, they're tied to the breweries. That's where the term Tide House comes from. And it was an English thing. It goes way back before the founding of the colonies, where in England you had chains of pubs that were owned by breweries, and then they were rented out to people to run them. Here, a lot of them were owned by folks who were independent from the brewery, but they were financially supported by the brewery so that they would serve their beer.
Gotcha. Okay. And you mentioned that with beer gardens, they generally were being closed before the 1900s, and Tide houses stopped continuing after the passing of Prohibition. So what happened to Tide houses and beer gardens after Prohibition passed?
Yeah, Prohibition was, it was the end for Tide houses. They ran right up until Prohibition, and then by the time Prohibition ended, the three-tier law was formed, which basically says that there's no vertical integration in the alcohol business because of the three-tier law. So you have the producer, who would be the brewery. You have the wholesaler, or the distributor, who would buy from the brewery and then sell to a retailer. So producer, distributor, retailer, and no one person or one group could own more than any one of those things at a time. So you couldn't own a bar and a brewery, or a distributor and a brewery. And that was their way of busting up basically what could have been a monopoly, what sort of was a monopoly at the time with Tide houses. So immediately after Prohibition, those buildings would have all been sold if they were owned by the breweries. And I mean, at that point, very few breweries actually survived through Prohibition anyway. A lot of those buildings had already been either turned into something else completely, or they'd been sold as taverns that would open up independent of breweries after Prohibition. In Milwaukee, you had, a lot of people have heard of the Palm Gardens, and you still have the Pabst Theater, which Pabst actually did help fund. But you had these really famous places that had been gathering spots for entertainment, for celebrations, for things like that. And that, you know, a lot of those closed. Some stayed open independently. But yeah, the Tide House system was tough for the breweries, but it was a good thing for independent bar owners. Beer gardens were basically off the map until Estabrook opened not that long ago, less than 15 years ago, over in Shorewood. So there were like no beer gardens in Wisconsin between Prohibition and 2010-ish. And now people have kind of realized how much fun they are. They're great for communities. They're great for breweries. The proliferation of craft breweries has really helped the beer garden kind of explode in popularity again. But it took a long time.
And at Old World Wisconsin, there will be different brewing experiences around, so you won't just be serving Schlitz or Pabst or one beer like the Tide houses, but there'll be different brewing experiences. What can visitors expect to experience and to see at the new brewing site?
Well, what you'll experience this summer is the brewhouse being open, and we'll be brewing every day. We'll be kind of going through a lineup of historic beer styles. We'll be tapping casks that we brewed earlier for sampling every day. So you can come and sample what beer might have tasted like, 150 years ago. We also have moved a tavern to the site. It's called Whitnables Tavern, and we moved that down from Old Asherton. The building is here, and it's in place. The exterior restoration will happen this year, and then the interior will hopefully be done sometime next summer. So the tavern's not open yet. Now, Whitnables was never a Tide house. It was a rural tavern. We're excited to get that up and running at some point, fingers crossed, next year. And then the beer garden that we'll be creating will be after that, and that'll be tied to our rebuild of our restaurant on site. And then once the beer garden's open, we'll have the ability to kind of recreate that old German experience that has now kind of been taken over by just the multitude of cultures in Wisconsin. Everybody goes to beer gardens, not just Germans. And we're super excited for that. And we'll feature a ton of beers, including some that were actually inspired by Old World Wisconsin. We're excited to see everybody and party some beer.
Sounds really exciting, Rob, especially as the weather gets nicer. Thank you so much, Rob, for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today to talk about tide houses and beer gardens.
Of course. Thanks for having us. We look forward to seeing everybody.
Rob Novak is the Historic Brewing Experience Coordinator at Old World Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Tavern Tuesdays is a partnership with Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin. Old World Wisconsin's brewing experience is now open to the public. You can find all of our Tavern Tuesday conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how gay conversion therapy can be harmful to a person's mental health and tell you about an effort to ban it in communities throughout Wisconsin. Plus, hear some new local music released this month in our Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.